Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turfs Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
And a pleasant good afternoon and evening to those of us across the country, and want to welcome you to the Water Zone. I'm your host, Rob Starr, along with our other unbelievable host, co-host, Mr. Chris Davey. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, thanks very much. I'm feeling great. And by the way, I don't think it's afternoon anywhere in the States anymore, except maybe Hawaii.
Oh, yeah. They got our station, so we got to say that.
Ah, they do indeed. How you doing out in Arizona? It's a nice, mild winter day today here in Southern California. It's beautiful, actually.
Yeah, it's about 75 out here. Beautiful sunshine, and it's supposed to be that way for the rest of the week.
Yep. So we have family that live in Fargo-Moorhead metropolitan area in Fargo, North Dakota, and today's high was minus 10. The low tonight, minus 29. You better have your woolly socks and beanies ready.
A few pairs of socks and a couple beanies and your thermal undies, because it's going to be it's freezing. I don't even know how to explain that. It's cold. I don't know how even people work in those kind of weather.
Hey man, colder than the Eskimo's nose on the shady side of the iceberg.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, I'm glad you're back, as I said last week. It's nice that you could talk more than a couple words, when we had the COVID thing. And you sound great. I know you are, because I talked to you all week, and that's a good thing. And a lot of good things are happening around the country and world. And one of the best things that we got going is having the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, Ms. Chris Austin, joining us tonight. As always, Chris, welcome.
Hey, how you doing, everybody? Good to have you back, Chris.
Thank you.
So we can be the stereo Chris's again.
That's right. Chris and Chris.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I remember that one night we had everybody that was a Chris.
We did.
Both of you and two guests. I was the only one who was out of step. I guess I should change my name. But.
Chris Austin is the best, though.
That's left over from New Year's. Come on.
It is.
you hoarder, you. Anyway. So what's up in California? I hear that competition is heating up among California cities over an increasingly rare and valuable commodity, which we all know as water. So tell us about the water wars that are starting to happen again.
Oh, yeah, that was the lead story today. There's another lawsuit pending in Kern County, which, some people in Kern County would tell you, they file lawsuits just so they can have a reunion every so often. a lawsuit over water in Kern County is nothing new. The issue really is over this concept of water banking. And, there is some uncertainty involved. Like when you go to a bank and you deposit money, then you know how much money you've deposited there, and the bank tells you your interest or whatever, and it's all kind of known. But Kern County has a big groundwater banking system in place where they actually take water from people and they sink it into the ground, and then when dry times come, these agencies can call on that water, and they can get that water back. Now, unlike a business or a bank where you put your money in and it gives you interest and it accrues, when you put money in a water bank, it's actually kind of the opposite. There's a percentage that you put in that stays in the basin, and there's other percentages involved. So rather than coming out ahead, you come out a little bit behind. But it's a great way for agencies, water agencies, to put water away for a rainy day. And they Kern County has been a master at this, and they've really, because they had a lot of empty groundwater basins, and they've been able to, you know, put a lot of water aside. And this is actually statewide, even though it's in Kern County. Like, for instance, I believe Santa Clara Valley Water District, which is in San Jose, banks water in Kern County. But it's not like when they call on that water in Kern County that Kern County somehow pumps that water up to San Jose. There's actually transfer agreements and exchange agreements in place so that, you know, Santa Clara will get their water from someone that has, that can deliver that actual water to them in exchange for water being delivered elsewhere further down the line. So it's very complicated, but they really have it worked out. And water banking in Kern County has been really very useful, especially the Southern California water agencies, you know, who have been able to bank water for times in drought. And when we had the last drought, things were really much less worse than they could have been for us down here because of all this banked water. But when you are a person who lives in this, in these areas of these water banks, really it all comes down to accounting. And while we can account for dollars and cents very efficiently because there are, we all have money, and we, that is very, you know, we know what that is, and it's all set up. Water under the ground is a little bit more uncertain. How much water is down there? And if you put water down there and then you later take it out, you know, how, whose water are you taking? And we, you know, the Central Valley is split up into all these different groundwater basins that are all sort of set up under convenient lines. But the truth is that the Central Valley is really one big whole groundwater basin. And there are flows, you know, water goes where it's going to go, regardless of what jurisdictional line that humans place above it. And the Central Valley and the San Joaquin Valley, it's all divided up as such. So when a water bank in a limited area puts water into the ground, and then later they come back out and they take it, are they taking the water that was put in there in the first place? It's a big question. And I don't think there are any solid answers. And so there's a new project that is, you know, going to put water in the ground and bank it and take it out at later times. And people in the area are a little concerned, as they usually are, that this type of lawsuit in the southern San Joaquin Valley, particularly Kern County, is not unusual, because these water banking operations have unintentionally dried up other areas because, again, the groundwater doesn't flow in the areas, you know, simply because, you know, we humans have drawn a jurisdictional line, you know.
You know, one of the things I heard a long time ago is that it was very difficult to measure the quantity of water underground in deep areas, meaning, you know, does it penetrate the earth or other things while it's underground? Does it move away from the, I'll just put it, the main hole, I guess I could say that. I don't know what else I would call it. But like you said, you know, you can put water in, but do they have an accurate way? Because I've heard it's very difficult to measure that water. Because what would happen if you have a deep storage area and pressure builds up and it pushes out outer walls underneath the ground so the water penetrates and moves away? I mean, how do they, what do they do? I mean,
it's a mystery to me. It's where the real uncertainty lies. I mean, honestly, you don't know. We are getting much better at mapping groundwater. As a matter of fact, there's a whole initiative. They're going to be doing this procedure called airborne electromagnetic surveys, where a helicopter with this sort of, like, contraption underneath it flows at low levels over the land, and it can see, to a certain extent, the water and the aquifer and the geology and the soils that are there. I mean, it's very high tech, but,
right.
You know, we still, honestly, we don't know for certain. We cannot say how much water is in any particular groundwater basin, although we are getting much, much better at it. And the one thing that we do know is that we have depleted most of the, you know, the higher elevations of water in the aquifers, especially in the Central Valley. So if, you know, no one should think that we're like, we don't know if we're depleting the aquifer or not, because in many areas of the state, particularly the Central Valley, we are definitely depleting the aquifers. But how far down does that go? It can vary, and it's really uncertain. Although we're getting better, you know.
Yeah, I think the lower you go, the lower that you start drawing water, you see more contaminants and mixtures of other things. So I think that helps detect what the levels are. But again, that's an interest. So in your opinion, Ms. Austin, question, you know. And this is not a political question. And for you, both, either one of you, Chris. So they canceled the oil pipeline. What would both of you say to having water pipelines? Because there's snow and stuff in Fargo, North Dakota, with plenty of snow that you can pump the water and things like that. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I got to tell you, water pipelines, just like electrical transmission lines, I mean, when that pipeline is crossing your property or and it's slicing across the landscape, you know, there are issues with that. Plus, to be honest, who has the water to be in the pipeline? Sometimes people talk about the Mississippi River and, wow, there's flooding in the Mississippi River. And shouldn't we, you know, send all that water over to the west? And, oh, and the Great Lakes, there have actually been times when people have sort of said we should take Great Lakes water and ship it to the southwest. And then go even further back, we have what was called the North American Water and Power or something, and it was this very ambitious plan to dam all sorts of places in Canada and send that water all over the United States, not just to California, not just to the Southwest, but everywhere. And Power, it was very ambitious, and there are still people out there promoting that idea. But, you know, I think, I really think, and although I'm not supposed to have opinion, but I'll tell you my opinion is, regions need to be self-sufficient to the point they can with the resources they have. I don't think Southern California will ever be able to say we don't need any imported water, because I don't think that's possible. We're just too big. But I do think we need to figure out how to live with what we have. And I think, for the most part, communities, wherever you are, need to be thinking about how to live within the resources that you have, because water is not plentiful anywhere.
Right.
No. That's correct. Mr. Davies, what's your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can talk about conservation, you can talk about all that stuff, but if there's no water to begin with, then the rest of it, you know, the rest of it is meaningless, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, And I don't think that, I mean, the places that have grown around imported water, they're still there. And I don't think you can say we're not going to send you water anymore. But I do think that in terms of your own growth, you need not to be looking to where you can bring more water in. So I think you, wherever you are, you need to live within your means. But that doesn't mean it's not possible to grow, because there is space for water conservation and for better uses of water within each region. And there's recycled water and other things, you know, stormwater capture that you can employ, you know, to get the extra water that you might need. But I don't think you should be casting your eyes to the Mississippi River or the Great Lakes.
There's your pipeline, Rob.
Go ahead.
There's your pipeline, Rob.
There's my pipeline. But, you know, I look at things like on the West Coast, the desalination plants that are established already and some that are being planned. And there's also inland desal plants. And I know the technology has to be more enhanced to do something with the brine water and the heat generated from the methodologies and things. But, you know, technology comes around pretty quick these days. I mean, it used to take 20 years for something, you know, incredible to happen. Now it seems like every 6 months.
And they've had advancements in desalination technology.
Oh, somebody's got a radio in the background.
I didn't hear it. I don't know what that was. Somebody stepped on it.
You know, desalination technologies are improving, and, you know, it's still expensive, but who knows where we'll end up. And I think desalination could be a solution for some of communities that are close to the coast, but also brackish water desalination, inland desalination. I mean, this is another really great way, you know, that they have developed a lot of technologies for brackish water desalination, and there's a lot of that going on here in Southern California, which is basically cleaning up water in an aquifer that has some stuff in it. Brackish water is water that has salt in it, but not as much salt as seawater. So brackish water desalination is more cost efficient. It's not as expensive. So, you know, it's and there's a lot of that going on, and I'm sure we'll see more of that. So,
the biggest cost factor for desal is energy, of course, right? The energy to pump it through the filters and the reverse osmosis technology to do it. So as more and more wind and solar power comes into effect, right? I mean, power that you don't have to use other energies to generate. I think the switch point for desal is based on the cost of power to power those plants, right? Whether it's salt water or brackish or inland, it still costs money.
And energy is a big thing, but the other consideration is, you know, there's an output from those plants, a brine discharge. And there's brine discharge from the brackish desalination plants that we already have, but they have built a brine line, from, I don't know, the Santa Ana region. I believe it goes out to the ocean. So they have a way. So you have to kind of consider how you're going to get rid of that discharge. But, you know, there are people that say that we used to look at, you know, sewage and clean in that wastewater that came from it. We used to look at that as something we had to dispose of, and now we've learned we can clean it up, and that's a resource. And there are other people saying, you know, this brine discharge from desalination, we think of it as a waste that we have to get rid of. But there are opportunities to do something with that discharge, just as
it's just like years ago with the algae bloom. You know, everybody says it's bad, but there's companies, Chris and I had on the show a couple times, where there's companies that take that and they make vitamins and all kinds of other things out of it, mayonnaise. It was kind of really interesting to hear that. But, yeah, given technology over the years, I think, we'll be able to solve a lot of things.
Right.
What else do you see in the horizon on the latest news in California, Chris?
Well, you know, there is a report that's come out. You know, they've actually had a lot of success up in the Sonoma County area with something that they call forecast-informed reservoir operations. And basically, a lot of our reservoirs are still operated on, rule curves established in the 1950s, which basically say in the fall, if you have a certain amount of water in your reservoir and you don't have space for potential flood flows, then they would have to release the water to have space for potential flood flows. But if the winter storms didn't produce any flood flows, that often meant that your reservoir was at a lower level. Now you had a shortage. And so they have been working because, you know, we have gotten a lot better at looking ahead at weather forecasting, and we're getting a bit more accurate. And the other thing that they've put a lot of effort into is all this research on atmospheric rivers. And for whatever reason, for many years, atmospheric rivers were tended to be directed at the Russian River, Sonoma County area. Now they're much more, they seem to be much more widespread, but this is where the phenomena was really noticed. And so they've been paying a lot of attention. And atmospheric rivers are important because it's important to know where that big stream of moisture is going to come in on the coast. And if that river, that atmospheric river, is going to hit north of you, then maybe you don't have to drain your reservoir as much. And so with the improvement in just general weather forecasting, but also in being able to predict where atmospheric rivers are actually going to land, they've actually proven that they can be successful, and we're able to store more water in Lake Mendocino, which is on the Russian River, in these past few years because they have been paying attention to the forecast, and we know better now. You know, the big worry is that you're going to get an awful lot of rain that's going to overwhelm your reservoir and your dam, and that's dangerous, and we don't want that flooding. But if we're getting better so that we can say, you know, that you don't have to drain that reservoir so much. And this is actually probably the best hope, I think, for most reservoir operations in California, because they're going to start going through and readjusting these flood rules that they have that were in the 1950s. You know, established in the 1950s, they're going to be going through and they're going to be updating them. These changes will eventually go around statewide, and it's going to be very helpful. It's updating things.
Geez, Chris, this is just so, you know, every week I wish we had more time to talk to you. Rob, maybe one day we should do a whole show with Chris. But I know your kids and husband are probably banging on the door saying, hey, time for dinner. But this is related to, do you remember the story, Kristen, there about that National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration put out for the S2S precip forecasting?
Yeah, definitely. I was kind of headed there. I hadn't gotten yet.
I saw the relationship there. And it's like a two-year prediction thing. Now that all of supercomputers can put models of weather systems throughout the globe, right? They're now being able to get some increased level of confidence that precip prediction can go out not just weeks and a month, but actually a couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't it be great to know in the summertime if the next winter was going to be wet or dry? and how you would manage your water knowing that you had a dry year coming. I mean, the advances that they've made in meteorology and prediction is incredible. I mean, they now know about these oscillations that happen on a decadal time scale, but you know, you can only get that by collecting data for several decades before you can look at it and go, oh, hey, look at this. You know, so it's amazing. We're really reaping the benefits of, you know, decades of, you know, research.
Yeah, I think for the present day, if I'm right, there's the NOAA is asking Congress for some multiple million of dollars of stuff to look at this, see if they can implement it, right? So it goes from a concept to actual implementation.
Yeah, and, you know, I think there's a lot of momentum behind the movement, and I think it's going to reap benefits, you know. So it sounds to me like they're headed, you know, they're headed to get this approved, and it's been building momentum for a number of years, and there's a lot of research behind it. And also, besides this, there's all the work that NASA's doing on measuring the snowpack in the Sierras and getting a better handle on how much water is above, you know, all these reservoirs in the snowpack. So, you know, so much research. It's really exciting and amazing what they're going to be able to do.
Yeah. So before NASA does that, we don't have to hike up to, you know, that meadow and do the manual snowpack measurement. Man, Rob and I have this dream that we want to go up there with those guys and be present when they do that and do a story on it.
Well, yeah. The trick is, you know, when you do that, it's a point measurement. It's where the snow is at this point. But it doesn't tell you what the overall snowpack is. And so what NASA's working on is being able to survey that whole snowpack and be able to tell you wholly what it is, not just what we can figure out from the single point measurements. So
right, you are.
Exciting stuff, you know.
Really, I know the Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, is pushing for a lot of that money and seems to be being successful. We're up against our halftime break here, Ms. Chris, and we appreciate you coming on to the show. And to our listeners, if you want to know everything about California water news and what's going on, please go be a subscriber or a donator to mavensnotebook.com. And it's a great thing to take over and look. And we get it every single day on our computers, and it's the best source of the water news that we know. So, become a sponsor, become a subscriber. We both are, for both Chris and I, in the show. And we want to give our best to her for being with us all every week. And Chris, I think it's time for you to go make dinner for your hubby so he don't get mad at
us. Yeah, I don't know. They're all hungry. Got to throw something at them.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you next week, Chris.
Okay, good evening, everyone.
Have a great week, Chris.
You too.
All right. We'll be back next week for our commercials, and we'll be right back.
This is 1050 AM KCAA Loma Linda and 106.5 FM Yucaipa.
Are you looking for a place to buy your landscape and gardening items? Come visit us at Site One Landscape Supply. We offer a large and quality selection of irrigation, landscape, and outdoor living products such as Toro's water-efficient precision nozzles. Site One Landscape Supply has over 30 locations right here in Southern California, and we are the largest national wholesale distributor of landscape supplies in the United States. Site One's knowledgeable and friendly staff is equipped to help you with all your landscape, irrigation, and outdoor living projects. Whether you're redoing your backyard into a drought-tolerant garden or creating a water-efficient landscape for your client, Site One has everything you need, including the latest in water-saving technologies, drought-tolerant plants for your yard, irrigation supplies, fertilizer and weed control products, landscape accessories, hardscape products, outdoor lighting, and much, much more. Visit SiteOne.com to find a store near you or stop by today. Site One, we are stronger together.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
All right, so welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone with Rob and Chris, and I hope everybody's having a good evening and a pleasant one. And staying safe from COVID is most important to you, everybody. We have a special guest today, and out of full disclosure, I want to let you know that we have a gentleman named Mr. Brian Witcher, who works for the Toro Company. As a coincidence, that Chris and I also work for the Toro Company, and we know Brian for a long time. But as most of you know, and I just want to keep it clear, as most of you know, or all of you know who listen to the show, we do not promote Toro products, even though we work for Toro. And part of the reason of that is not that we don't like them or don't think they're the best, we do. But the show wasn't an intent to be an advertisement for Toro's products. It was to inform our listeners about water and what's going on in the world with technologies and legal affairs and everything else for that matter. So we just wanted to make that clear. We're not trying to hustle and sell you anything. But we wanted to bring somebody on who has a great experience in this industry. And Mr. Brian Witcher, he's our manager of district sales for irrigation, residential, and communication. And he's based out of Phoenix, Arizona. So, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Dave. Chris, so how's it going?
Going good here. Chris is doing well. One of the first questions we always ask, and I mean, we know the answers to this ahead of time, but how did you choose your career? How did you get into this business of irrigation? What made you make that decision?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it started way back when I was in high school, and I actually loved, I caught the golfing bug, and I loved to play golf. And so my first job was actually working on the golf course maintenance crew at my local golf course. One of the benefits of working on the golf course is you get to play free golf. So what better way to play as much golf as you wanted than to work on the golf course? So once I caught the golfing bug and then continued to working on the golf course, it just kind of kept evolving, and I've been in the green industry ever since, you know, contracting, distribution, and now through manufacturing. So it's just I've kind of hit all facets of the green industry and absolutely love it. So it happened many years ago back in high school.
Oh, I bet you didn't have to pay for the course fees, did you?
No, that's one of the benefits of being working on the golf course is every day after work, you can go out and play 3 holes or 9 holes, or during the summer when it's light out till late at night, you can play all 18. So I used to be a pretty good golfer, a lot better than I am now. So it was pretty cool.
Well, let's see if we can expand on that a bit, Brian. I mean, I know you a little bit. So back in those days when you were formulating your career, if you will, and working in on a golf course, it wasn't just maintenance you were doing. You actually did, you know, core right from the, you know, bare dirt installation, right?
Yeah, so part of the evolution of what I was doing, I was I started out on the maintenance side, but then actually just fell in love with it so much. I actually went to college and got my landscape and turf management degree, and then from there found an opportunity where I could actually go and build golf courses. So I actually built a course down in the Mid-Atlantic, Washington D.C. market. So maintaining and building from the ground up, which is an incredible experience.
I'm going to note for some of our listeners, Brian, because they often, on comments when they send us, they often tell us where they went to school and all that kind of stuff. Brian is a Virginia Tech alumni.
Go Hokies. Absolutely, yep.
And he got a business master's degree from the University of Phoenix and his MBA from Trident University.
Yeah, so I just wanted to continue to round out and within the green industry, and I just thought it was about growing grass and building golf courses, but I learned that there's a lot of business behind it too, and to be a resourceful asset to whatever you're going to do. I continued my education after my landscape and turf management degree, got my bachelor's from University of Phoenix in business management, and then recently finished my MBA. So I feel that I can be a true asset and help a lot of different facets of any company, of any customers that I have, and many different avenues that they're looking to, just with my experience and my education.
So the first half of your career was essentially East Coast oriented, Mid-Atlantic, New England, Washington, D.C. area, yeah?
Yeah. So I grew up in Connecticut, high school in Connecticut, and the first golf courses were on the shoreline of Connecticut, and then moved down to the D.C. market in college, went to Virginia Tech, and then continued on working in golf courses and building golf courses in the Northern Virginia area. Yep. So.
Right. Well, I think you're pretty primed. I mean, I know you well, and I know you're pretty primed when you go see and talk to potential customers and existing customers. I know you play a great role in relationships with them. But one of the things I know you talk about a lot, and, you know, is where we see the future of irrigation and things of that. It's, you talk a lot about technology, and maybe you want to give a little talk about that, how you approach that, and what do you see as the future?
Yeah, So one of the big things, a lot of conversation around water conservation and stuff. And what I've seen over the last, you know, literally couple decades that I've been in the industry is technology is moving so fast in our industry, in the green industry, from controllers to nozzles and water efficient delivery products, and it's getting less expensive and more adaptable, more attainable for even the residential market. So when I first started on golf courses, it was pretty awesome and pretty unique to have a weather station on a golf course and very expensive. Well, nowadays you can find weather sensing technology and controllers that can monitor and react to weather on residential systems that are very, very affordable. And so the technology has certainly sped up and become more affordable and more attainable to a broader market. And one of the things that I like to help my customers with and talk to them about is we as an industry, we really need to stay on top of it and start understanding this technology more and more, because this technology is moving so fast. It's really tough to stay on top of. So continuing to understand and learn and figure out what's going on is going to be vital to the continued adaptation, growth, and use of this technology, so we can continue to conserve water and to save money and just to be better stewards of the environment.
Do you think, I know you cover contractors and distributors and the whole realm of everybody who touches irrigation, do you see, aside from the Irrigation Association, who has classes and you can get certified to be a certified landscape irrigation auditor and water manager and all of that, do you see the broad landscape contractors who do, like, say, HOAs and places like that, do you see that they do more into the water management, or they're strictly, and I don't want to use the term mow and blow, but just the maintenance? I mean, do you see enough of those companies that are more educated, not just having one or two people in a company that maybe has 600 to 1,000 employees? I mean, do you see a need for more people to be trained? Like in Texas, to be an irrigator, you need a license, a certification. Like California, you don't. You know, and there's a big difference in having somebody who has a knowledgeable and goes for a certification and really understands the methods and the means how to do water management versus somebody coming in and say, well, I'll just turn the water up more, turn it less. How do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. So part of when I talk to contractors, I talk to HOAs, I talk to architects, the whole gamut, sports field and everything. One of the biggest areas that I think that we as an industry can do better at is to keep up with the technology, keep up with the education. Like I said before, that this technology is progressing so fast. I mean, it really is. I mean, if you just think of the technology you hold in your hand with an iPhone, I mean, new iPhones are coming out every year. Well, that technology is migrating into, for example, just the irrigation controllers. That technology is moving so fast. We as an industry really need to stay on top of it, and I see that technology is actually moving faster than we as an industry is able to keep up with it and stay on top of it and learn from it. So it's becoming more and more of a challenge, I believe. A lot of people in the industry are trying to keep up on top of it and take your classes and things like that. But we really need to do more of it and really to stay on top of it and to understand the trends and keep adapting to the changes in the technology and the changes in the information that's being given to us through this technology.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary, Brian. I've got to add one more thing to that. You know, people have been talking of using the term water management for years, 25, 30 years or plus, right? I mean, back in the 90s, people were talking about it. And really, when it first came on, you know, when it first came on the scene, people were saying, we're thinking of it rather as water conservation more than anything else. But now it's really, well, how do we do it these days, right? I mean, even smart controllers, it's kind of old stuff these days, right? Now it's soil moisture sensors and different types of metering and measurements and flow monitoring, and all this stuff just produces instant information at your fingertips on your phone or device, right?
Absolutely, and you hit the nail on the head there, Chris. It's one thing to capture the data, and that's what this technology is allowing us to do, is to capture that data. But it's another thing to, what do we do with that data? And that's where the cultural aspects come into working with the data that we get. What do we do with that data? And that's where a lot of this this education and a lot of this information can really help conserve the water. I was talking to a colleague earlier today, and we were talking about this, about the conservation and this information that you get. And I came up with this analogy, and it's living here in Phoenix, you know, we have these, well, a lot of people have these, you know, the thermostats in their house, and how you keep the thermostats during the summer, at what temperature do you keep it at? Well, 70 degrees here in Phoenix during the summer at 4% humidity is different than 70 degrees at 80% humidity on the East Coast. So the temperature is just one aspect of what a comfort level is to the human body. And the water is just one piece of the information that we need to capture when we talk about cultural practices and water conservation. Because a quarter of an inch of rain means different during the summer as it does during the winter. So just because you got a quarter of an inch of rain, well, what was the, you know, what's the salinity of the soil? What's the fertility of the soil? What's going on? The water conservation is just one piece of it, or the amount of water is just one piece of it. It's what do you do with all this information, and can really help round out the whole water conservation discussion.
I know you talked about the adaption of the technology at the contractor level and also at the distributor, because they got to sell the product. They have to understand what it does so they can convey it to their customers. Do you find that distributors are more interactive today in that, or they just leave it to the contractor that comes in and gets it? And then what about the end user? Because after the contractor puts the stuff in and goes away, it's left in the hands of the user, who really doesn't know as much as the contractor or the distributor. And we see a lot of problems with that.
Yeah, so there's so much information. I mean, the information is out there. There's so much information on the internet. I mean, you can go to a search engine, you know, Google, Yahoo, whatever, and find out how to use that technology that you purchased, that controller or whatever. And the distributors my hat's off to them. I mean, they're in a tough situation because there is so many different brands out there. And they all do the same thing, but it's all with a little nuance or a little twist. It's tough to be an expert and knowledgeable of them all. And again, it's moving so fast to have a distributor and everybody within the branch and everybody within the distributor keep on top of all these changes and nuances is really, really difficult. So relying on the manufacturer to be the expert and to provide that information in the training, I think is going to be someone's best bet. Distribution is a good resource, absolutely, probably the first line of defense. But to really get into the nuts and bolts and the specific nuances and to really dial in any technology is something that's really, really important.
Do you think there's a role for water districts to participate in doing that?
So I every water district and everybody's going to be different. Meaning here in Arizona, SRP is a major water district. And they do provide some incentives and things like that. But as far as being an educational resource, that's really left up to, you know, distribution contractors and the manufacturers. It might be different in California as water districts play a different role. But it's really going to be regionalized.
We're seeing a little of that, Brian, these days, you know, with agencies, Metropolitan Water District getting involved. Have you seen any inkling that the Salt River Project, SRP, would begin to assume a role like that, or just this sort of mood on the subject?
Yeah, no. So here in Arizona, SRP does a good job of promoting water conservation and they provide an annual program to purchase to their customers where they can purchase smart controllers at a discount. But as far as we go back to being experts and understanding what information you have, setting up a smart controller takes a level of knowledge and expertise. Whereas SRP is incentivizing their homeowners to purchase a smart controller, you still have to set it up correctly and put the correct information in. So Some of those nuances might be a little technical for the general public, and SRP is not going to be the resource that you're going to turn to for that. So whereas it's just one piece of the puzzle is getting that smart controller, getting that technology into the hands is good, but you still have to set it up correctly and put the right information in. It's all about, you know, setting up correctly, putting the right information in so you get a good output at the end of the day.
Yeah, garbage in, garbage out kind of thing, right?
Exactly, yep.
Yeah. So. What do you see as kind of like the NBT, right, next big thing? And smart controllers are sort of already on the scene right now, right? They're kind of quite prevalent now, especially in the residential market, in the homeowner market. What do you kind of see as the next big thing?
Yeah, so going back to what we talked about earlier about water is just one piece of the pie when it comes to, you know, how much water you're going to need. I think we're going to get, I would imagine that, and I hope that we get more information when it comes to pulling information out of the soil, when it comes to fertility level, your salinity, your pH, whatever the information is going to be important, because water is just one piece of it. And we might be able to irrigate less of something if we get the right soil chemistry correct. So hopefully someday in my lifetime, we're going to have a technology that's going to tell us that Your plant material has a you need to adjust the pH and the salt level or whatever. And oh, by the way, if you do that, you can actually irrigate 15% less. So because they all go hand in hand, they all kind of work off of each other. So I think there's some technology out there that already exists that's given us some of that basic information, and I think that's going to continue to evolve. And I hope it does, because like I said, you know, water is a scarce resource, and there is a way to even fine tune it even more by capturing more data and more information, you know, based on, like I said, you know, salinity, pH levels, fertility, things like that. So I think it's one piece, and as we continue to get more information and how we use that data, is going to be even a greater consequence to our water conservation effort.
Interesting case just recently, Brian, about EC, conductivity in the soil, right? I mean, I know we've been using that. We use that now. That's the basis behind soil moisture sensing, but used on a broader scale in agriculture in third world countries. Very interesting. I have to share it with you.
That'd be fantastic.
Well, you notice when they grow Christmas trees, a lot of the lots are situated underneath power poles, power distribution centers, because that helps stimulate the ground. Brian, in your view, where do you see the future of landscaping in your district, in Phoenix area or Arizona area, compared to the rest of the country? I mean, where do you see it going, and what is it going to look like?
Yeah, you know, so we've gone through many, many trends. Part of my background is, and the reason I came to Phoenix is my grandparents moved out here in the 1940s, and they bought a house that was way far out. Well, you know, 70 years later or 80 years later, that area is now literally downtown Phoenix. And so if you look at a map of Phoenix and what it looks like in the suburbs, you can see how it's changed over the years. Downtown Phoenix, and believe it or not, the older homes have big, nice, lush, green yards. And then you get to the suburbs, and they're tiny postage stamps that are drip. It's all rock and a couple plants, and it's pretty interesting to see the different trends of over the decades of what the landscaping is. A lot's going to depend on the water rights and the water allocations. That here in the West that we have. I know you guys talk about it a lot with Chris, your previous guest, about the water rights and what everybody's going to have. When you talk about Las Vegas, when you talk about Arizona, Southern California, and who has rights to the Colorado River. And so I think a lot's going to depend on the future of water availability and what happens. But it's going to be very interesting what happens over the next decade and what the landscape does look like. I can tell you though that there's quite a push right now for a lot of the athletic fields to go to synthetic, just because they don't use as much water. So a lot of fields are going synthetic in the high school, junior high area. So I can see that trend continuing for the next quite a few years, just because of the water conservation.
Okay. Well, we're getting close to the news hour that we have to turn back over to NBC, but Brian, it's a pleasure having you on. I mean, I miss seeing you all the time when you come out to the Riverside, and I'm closer to you now in Phoenix, but, you know, with the COVID situation, it makes it a little difficult. But we really appreciate you coming on the show and giving us insight to what's going on in the industry and how you see it. Your feet and ear are right to the ground, and we do appreciate that.
Yep, anytime. Love talking with you guys. So anytime, we can do this again, anytime.
Great. So on behalf of the water... Thanks very much. And to all our listeners, the one thing Chris and I want all of you to know and all of you to do is your main task is to...
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.